So the oak tree was considered the most sacred tree in ancient Greece. It was associated with Zeus, who was the king of the Olympian gods. And Zeus was in control of the sky, thunderstorms. He would throw lightning bolts, and he was just the man in charge. And there is scientific evidence that oak trees are the type of tree that get hit most by lightning. So perhaps the ancient Greeks noticed this happening, and they said this must be Zeus's tree because he keeps throwing his lightning bolts at it.
You're listening to Herb Mentor Radio by Learning Herbs. I'm John Gallagher.
And I'm Tara Ruth. Today we're chatting with Maria Christodoulou. Maria is a clinical herbalist exploring the wisdom of ancient Greek herbal medicine. Based in Athens, Greece, she is the author of The Greek Herbalist's Guide to the National Garden and The Greek Herbalist's Guide to the Mountain. For more info, you can visit thegreekherbalist.com.
Maria, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you.
And all the way from Athens. Like, you're not from Athens originally, right?
That's correct. I'm originally from New York, and I moved to Athens about 3 years ago.
What compelled you to move to Athens?
Well, I consider myself a COVID baby because I was living in New York City at the time of COVID, and there was a mass exodus of people from the city because it was such a difficult time. And Greece had already been on my mind. So the opportunity came, and I got on a plane, and when all the lockdowns were over in Europe, I resettled here, and it's been a really great experience, of course, with its ups and downs, but I'm really happy to now be living in Athens.
And it seems like the first thing you did when you landed was went right outside and started identifying and using the herbs that grow in Athens. Is that correct?
That is correct, because a lot of the plants here we have in the States, and yes, they are the same plants, maybe different species, but it was quite a wonderful experience, especially in wintertime, which you would not expect. Mm-hmm. But wintertime is not a bleak and desolate period for the plants. They actually come up, and it's green in Athens. We don't get a lot of snow here. So we have calendula, dwarf nettle, mallow. This is February, and the hillsides and even the cracks in the sidewalks have color and flowers blooming. So it's really fun.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear more about how you work with these plants, like mallow, for example. Can you tell us a little bit about mallow?
Sure.
Is it like that little mallow that's like the weed, or is it like the big marshmallow that you grow in a garden? Or,
well, this mallow is wild. And I live near a park in Athens. I'm in the center of Athens. And it's a medium-sized leaf, so it's not super small, and it's a Malva species. There's a variety of Malva species here, and it hasn't started to flower yet, but the leaves just spread across as much space as they can find. They will just spread very easily, and I really like to use it in my herbal tea blends when I'm feeling really frazzled and stressed, and I find it's a very good herb to soften stress edges. So the edges that I feel when I've got a lot going on and I just need some softness in my life. That's kind of how I see mallow, as a very soft, gentle energy, even though it's very vibrant and good for respiratory system, digestive system. I really use it for me in an herbal tea blend to soften the edges when I'm feeling hard and tired, essentially.
I love that you're bringing in that idea, the energetics around softness and with an herb that feels so, it's so mucilaginous too.
Exactly.
And creates this soft texture, viscous texture.
Will you make a cold infusion when you do that?
Well, I use the mallow leaves and flowers.
Okay.
And I do a regular hot infusion with some other herbs. So sometimes I like to blend it with hawthorn leaves and flowers and berries. I put in some olive leaves, maybe some nettles. So whatever I have, really, whatever I see first is what I put in the teapot.
Oh, I just gave you an idea. Whatever I see first, tea.
Yes. It's like, this all sounds great. Let's throw some herbs together. And that's my herbal tea for the day. I make a big pot.
Delicious. Oh, that sounds great. You also talked about dwarf nettle, which I'm not familiar with dwarf nettle. Can you talk about that plant and how you like to work with that one?
Sure. So this is another one that I see growing wild. So I'll see mallow, calendula, dwarf nettle, arugula. They're just all like neighbors in the same patch of land and in the city center. So dwarf nettle doesn't grow very tall. So that's why it's called dwarf nettle. And it also has the nice stings on it to kind of remind you like what kind of plant this is.
Not soft.
And I, of course, use it in herbal tea blends. It's very easy to find in herbal tea shops here. And again, I use it when I need a boost in energy. If I'm feeling depleted, you know, if I'm sitting at the computer a lot, I feel very depleted because it's, you know, just work staring at a screen is not very healthy for many hours. So nettles, dwarf nettle really helps revitalize the body and replenish the minerals. So it's one of my go-to herbs for that.
So we're talking about an urtica species like the stinging nettle that a lot of people listening know. And is it that there's not much of the larger stinging nettle growing near you? Or is it just that the dwarf nettle is accessible and is, you know, easier to use? Or
Exactly. Yep. This is just a species that is, it grows wild here. It's easy to find, easy to harvest. I've also made nettle pesto, which is delicious. And it's just an alternative to drinking it. You can eat it. So you just have to be careful when you're removing all the leaves from the stems just to wear gloves. But it's also a food source.
Yeah. Is it a common food source, or a lot of people traditionally use it or still use it, or are they looking like you're a little crazy when you're out there picking it?
Well, it's interesting because when I first moved to Greece, I had expected to find an herbal community here. And one of the surprises about living in Greece is that herbal medicine isn't trendy here, or it's not quite, there's a disconnect between the generations. So the older generations have a very close connection to the land because they probably grew up in the mountainside in a village, or they still live there, as opposed to people who live in the city and who have never lived in a village, or they just aren't connected to the plants in the same way. So what's happening now is there's a loss of cultural traditions with plants. So people may not know what mallow and dwarf nettle are used for, or calendula even. So one of my goals of living here is to change that. And to make it trendy again, to drink herbal tea.
Right. And do that through the point of view of like their own heritage, right? Versus.
Exactly. It's abundant here. The amount of medicinal plants growing wild is phenomenal.
You know, in the process of living in Athens and moving there and just kind of figuring more about the landscape of herbalism in terms of how popular it is in different generations. How have you gone about learning about the herbs that are growing around you? Has it been talking more with elders or doing historical research? Or
yeah, that's a great question. So it's been a combination of efforts. A couple of years ago, I was the recipient of a grant from NYU. They have a society that gives out grants for research and community-based events. So I had a grant that helped me travel around Greece and meet with women in particular who still work with the land. So I met with a woman who has continued on the traditions of winemaking. She lives in the countryside in the Peloponnese. I met with a woman who runs a center that focuses on Hippocratic medicine and his legacy in herbal medicine. And she's on the island of Kos. And I met with an herbalist who lives in Corfu. And she knows quite a lot about herbs because she did online courses with teachers in the U.S.
I just watched that TV show, What Takes Place on Corfu.
Oh, yeah.
The Masterpiece Theater one, Dorel's of Corfu.
Yeah, it's very popular. Yeah. Corfu's a beautiful island. So everywhere you go, it's really, there's so much to learn everywhere you go, and everyone has a different perspective. And I've also done a lot of reading and research and being out in the landscape. Also, I've learned a lot about how plants grow and where they grow and where different species are concentrated. So it's definitely been a learning experience. And I've had a lot of really interesting conversations with people. So I've just accumulated all of that over the past 3 years, and there's still so much for me to learn. So I'm very excited to see what the future holds and how many more people I can meet and continue on the promoting all the cultural traditions with plants here.
What a beautiful way to learn about the herbs, just bringing in all these different personal connections and building relationships, and then also doing that more, research.
Now, do you find, like, you were just talking about nettles before, and one of my favorite meals that Kimberly like make me on my birthday or something is spanakopita with nettle. Is that just like an American herbalist going, let's put nettles in spanakopita, or do people in Greece ever put nettles in spanakopita?
They do. I have. And we also have...
Did we make that up?
No, you did not. We also have plants here that are wild grasses. They call them horta, which translates to like wild grasses or wild green plants. And they have horta pies. So instead of spinach pies, they have horta pies. So nettles would be included in that. And horta also is a side dish at a Greek restaurant here. So it's very common. Like everyone here knows what horta is. And depending on the time of year, horta can be a different plant. So it could be amaranth leaves. It could be almira, which I don't know what the English word is, but I think it's sea fennel or something related to sea fennel. So spinach spanakopita can be any green, depending on the season or month, or what is most abundant. So yeah, of course, nettles, put them in.
You also mentioned arugula earlier. What is that, another herb that just gets thrown into the pies, et cetera? Or how do you like to work with arugula?
So arugula is a very common plant here, also grows wild, and it's used raw in salad mixes. And it's really quite interesting. When I first saw arugula at the nearby park, I was looking at it and I was like, that looks so familiar. And I was like, this can't be arugula. Arugula doesn't, how does it grow wild? So it was just this one of these moments of like, yes, there is arugula growing wild. And right now it's in flower here. And you can just eat it from the ground. It's there. There's, if you're in a public space, you just have to be careful of, if there are people walking their dogs, what could be left behind. So you just have to be careful of that kind of the unintended consequences of picking wild plants in a public space.
Totally. Yeah. Wow, that would rock my world just to see arugula growing wildly around me.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
You also mentioned earlier calendula.
Yes.
Yes. And so calendula just growing wild everywhere too.
Exactly. And, yes.
My gosh.
So you don't need a garden.
You don't. You just need a public, you just need access to an outside space.
It's clean from
exactly
pollution.
Exactly. And dogs and animals. I led a botanical hike on Sunday, and we found a spot on a mountain, which is, Athens is surrounded by mountains. So by car, it's only 10 minutes. So we did a botanical hike and we found a patch of calendula, and it's just such a treat to see a patch of calendula, especially in wintertime, because it just is a reminder of happiness. And it's such an herb that even when we take it internally, it helps boost our mood. It's like the sunshine herb. So I did collect some calendula. I'm drying it now. I'm going to put it in some herbal teas. And the calendula species in Greece is Calendula arvensis. And it's a smaller flower head. And it's known to be more potent than Calendula officinalis.
Oh.
So it's higher in resin and it can have a stronger effect on the body when you use it for medicinal purposes. So it's a very cool plant, especially to find growing wild, because it's really good medicine on so many levels.
Mm. Wow. And is it the same kind of effects, but just a more amplified version, like digestive and skin and lymphatic support?
Exactly. Wow. Yes.
That's so cool. Just concentrated in those cute little flower heads.
And thyme also, there have been studies that the thyme species in Greece also are more potent. And one of the reasons is the climate, because if the climate is, if plants are more stressed in a climate, they have less water content. So they have higher medicinal qualities, more phytoconstituents with less water content. So it's a good, they're just a great, great medicine growing all around us. Great source of plant medicine.
Yeah. Well, that's like yarrow, like in my yard or in the wetter part of the state. You could just, you take it and chew on it. And it just like tastes like something green. But then you go to Eastern Washington where it's dry.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, that's yarrow,
Exactly.
It makes a big difference.
Climate makes a big difference. Soil, pollution, of course. So all good medicine.
Gosh, Tara, Maria's life seems like a dream. I mean, right?
I know.
Going to this sunny Mediterranean country and immersing yourself in the culture and the food and the wine and the herbs. Ugh.
And she's done so much research, She's really living the medicine too. Just so beautiful.
Living the medicine. I really like that. I think that's a really, that should be a name of a course right there.
Noted.
No, you got that. Write that down. Speaking of courses, folk medicine is a course that you just produced on Herb Mentor.
Yes, with Sherelle Washington.
So what similarities do you see between, what is that course and what similarities do you see between the approach of that course and what we're talking to Maria about?
Yeah, so the full name of the course is Folk Medicine, Changing the Narrative. And in this course, Sherelle Washington walks us through the fundamentals of what is folk medicine and really breaking things down so that we can make really powerful herbal remedies in our own kitchens, connect with the ingredients around us that are accessible, and then also ask ourselves what kinds of medicines our ancestors made and how we can connect with these ancestral practices through our hands, through making things in our kitchens with, but by ourselves and also in community.
Community, making things with our hands, keeping things simple. I'm sure these are, the foundations of Greek folk medicine and herbalism as well, and all folk herbalism around the world.
Yeah, and finding the complexity and the simplicity too. It might just be, for example, in folk medicine, Sherelle created so many great recipes, and one of them was a fig-infused wine, and it's just figs. but there's something really profound about the simplicity there, and you get to learn more about that specific plant and then all of the different gifts that it offers and the different ways that it will shine in different forms. So with this fig wine, you'll have the wine itself, but then you have the figs left over too after you infuse them. Then they're going to be wine-infused figs.
This is the fun part of herbalism. It isn't about making capsules and tinctures and trying to fix our health problems. It's about life, living the medicine, as you just said, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. It's so fun. And making things taste good too.
Yeah.
Like when I first started learning about herbs, I got really excited about tinctures and really, really powerful things. And I would notice a lot of these tinctures would just sit on my shelves for years.
Yeah.
And while there are totally tinctures in folk medicine, there's a really different approach here. It's a lot of food-based things. Mm-hmm. And then also maybe the tincture has some honey in it, or instead of being made with a really high percentage alcohol, it's made with bourbon. There's all these little things to make these medicines more accessible to us and to the folks in our lives.
Well, we both know herbalists who really geek out and stay in the area of those tinctures and helping people in chronic conditions and that medical clinical herbalism. But for most of us, especially probably for 99% of the people listening to this podcast or a part of Learning Herbs or Herb Mentor, it really is what you're saying. You know, it's like, that's what keeps it interesting.
Sure. And there's another great part of this folk medicine series called Embracing Bioregional Herbalism. And in this section, Shirelle really talks about how to get to know the plants that are growing around you. And, you know, even the grocery stores around you, like what do they stock? What herbal things do they stock? And I'm thinking about Maria talking about that and just the specificity of the plants around her and how we can all kind of cultivate those really specific relationships with the plants that grow around us and what gifts do those offer.
That sounds wonderful.
Sounds pretty great, right?
So you can get access to the entire Learning Herbs course library on Herb Mentor. And of course, you can go to learningherbs.com to join anytime. But as a listener to Herb Mentor Radio, we have a little URL set up, easy to remember. What is it again, Tara?
HerbMentorRadio.com.
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 HerbMentorRadio.com. Side effects include
having a really good time for like not a lot of money. Like it's a really good deal.
Having a good time for not a lot of money is really, that should be our slogan.
Yeah.
A good time without a lot of money.
An official slogan. Right.
We should get back to our interview with Maria and I mentioned earlier, watching with Kimberly that show, The Durrells of Corfu, that takes place on the island of Corfu. It's like a PBS thing. And you just want to be there when you're watching this. And so I'm just like, oh, you know, the sun and the culture and everything. So just talking to Maria really sounds like that could be a real thing. So,
yeah, I've gone on tour of some sort.
We'll be talking about that soon. We're up on this on the podcast. Anyway, thanks, Tara, for talking with me for a moment on the side, a little side hall conversation. I think we should get back into the interview. Maria's waiting for us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
We're coming.
Let's go. You're right there. Well, Maria, you were talking about how in a lot of your work, you weave in, you know, this botanical history. Then you've also talked about plant lore and mythology. And I'm wondering, can you share about a few of your favorite Greek myths that include herbs?
Yes. I'd be happy to. So,
story time.
Yeah. One of my favorite plants in botanical mythology and even in herbal medicine, where I use it in my herbal teas, is bay laurel or Laurus nobilis. And I feel like bay laurel is very underused in herbal medicine. And in Greece, it is a very common culinary plant. People use it in their lentil soup to help with digestion. It's a common tree. You do see it around growing. there's a, the National Garden is nearby in the center of Athens, and I do plant walks there. And there are probably like 20 bay laurel trees there. And yeah, so it's really great to see, wow, this is where the bay leaf comes from. It's not just a spice from the supermarket and some unknown, you know, it's not an unknown tree. It exists and it really thrives here. So the myth that is associated with bay laurel has to do with Apollo. Apollo was the god of the sun, music, medicine, and prophecy. So he had a lot of responsibilities. And he was struck by an arrow by Cupid, or Eros. So Eros struck him by one of his love arrows, and Apollo fell in love with a nymph called Daphne. So Daphne was, you know, very happy doing what she was doing. And then she has this god chasing after her and really wanting to possess her and for her to be his. So she's not interested. She kept running away from him. And finally, she got so tired of him chasing after her, she cried out to the gods for help. So the gods answered her prayer, and they transformed her into the bay laurel tree. When Apollo caught up with her, he sees that she's transforming into this tree. And he says, "I'm so sad that you can never be mine, but I will honor you always. Your leaves will never turn brown or fall off. My love for you will be eternal, and I will crown my victors with your leaves." So the tree became a symbol of his devotion and love.
Wow.
It became a symbol of protection, because the tree protected her from something she did not want. And it became a symbol of honor. So for all of the victors at competitions in honor of Apollo, they would be crowned with bay laurel leaves. And the term laurel or laureate is of honor. So it, the name means honor.
Oh, oh my gosh.
So it's,
whoa.
So it has a lot of symbolism still today. And the Greek name for bay laurel is Daphne, which is the name of the nymph or the young woman from antiquity. So she's still alive in these trees. We still call her by the name, and the tree is her embodied. She's embodied in this tree. If you ever go to New York City to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there is a life-size statue depicting Apollo and Daphne in an almost embrace, because he never got her to be his. So his arms are not quite touching her, and she's transforming into this tree. So this myth has been depicted in countless works of art, and this one in particular is quite a special one if you're ever in New York City to see it. So we have herbal medicine in museums, and most people don't know.
That's so powerful.
Well, what a great way to teach through the stories, and then people remember, right?
Exactly.
More about the herbs when they can tell a story behind it. Do any of these stories connect to some of the, like, the story connect to, I mean, any of the healing uses of bay?
Sure. So bay laurel is very good. Well, energetically, it can be used as a protection plant. So you can burn bay laurel leaves as an incense to help clear a room from unwanted energies. If someone came over your house and they just left a sour taste in your mouth afterwards, their energy was negative, you can use it as an incense to clear that out. For the immune system, for the physical body, bay laurel leaves are actually very good to boost the immune system. It's an antibacterial, antiviral. It's also very good topically if you have inflammation or arthritis. So things that you don't want, bay laurel can help you get rid of it. It can be used internally or topically as a poultice. So many uses. So many uses.
Do you also work with at least in California where I'm at, the species of bay trees they have bay nuts that people will harvest and roast and then go through a whole process to kind of turn them into like a nut butter. Ooh. Do y'all do that as well over there?
That would be so cool. I have not heard of that here. So I have not seen it. So I'm not sure. Maybe it was done in the past, but unfortunately, not in the present, but I'd be really curious to hear more about how people in California do that. That's really cool.
Yeah. My gosh. And for folks who want to learn more about bay as well, you wrote an amazing bay monograph, Plant Profile for Herb Mentor, that I had the pleasure of getting to read and offer very minimal edits on. It's so amazing. Yeah. And I'm really grateful to you for writing that. I learned a lot through that process.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. And the way that you just weave in myth and story is so beautiful, because that's how I learned about things as well. Like, that's how it stays in my memory.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what in your research and myths and stories and history, what surprised you the most about the use of plants in ancient Greece?
Oh, it was so prevalent in almost all of the religious ceremonies, the rituals, herbal medicines written by physicians. I have found my research, you know, I reference a lot of Dioscorides, who was an ancient Greek physician who wrote a textbook called De Materia Medica. Mm. He's from the first century. And I am always impressed reading about the concoctions that they made and how much more diverse they are than ours today. Mm-hmm. And how more complicated they were. One of the remedies, or one of the ways that they took herbal medicines, was infusing herbs in wine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And we don't do this today. We infuse herbs in alcohol and we take tinctures. But herbal wine in ancient Greece was very common. And it was an entire chapter in his encyclopedia, in his text. It was an entire book. So it's one of the things we've lost, the practice of today. Right. And just the creativity of how to use plants. I don't know. I'm just so impressed.
Well, with the wine, I wonder if it was like, hey, we make the wine first and then we're infusing herbs in it and bottling it. Or I'm wondering if they're fermenting the grapes with the healing herbs versus adding them to infuse later. Do you think that might be the case? Or
yes, they would take, it depended on the herb, but they would take grape must. And so squished grapes, let it ferment, and then add the herbs with it, and then make the wine. The wine would just come out from that. I don't exactly know how to make wine, but they had a whole process. And yeah, they put in the herbs with the wine and the grapes, and then they let it sit for 3 months or 6 months.
Wow.
So a good amount of time. And then they would store it in a jug, a clay jug, and then use it when needed. So
I think this is an opportunity for you, Maria, to bring this back.
I agree.
I'm talking about it's time to learn to brew some wine. You are in Greece after all.
I know. I am working on that. So we'll see. Hopefully in the next year or so, hopefully sooner. I did write an article recently for the Journal of the American Herbalist Guild about ancient wine in Greece. Or wine in ancient Greece. So herbal wine.
Wow.
So people are interested. It's in that the Journal of the American Herbalist Guild, the fall 2023 issue. So lots
subscribe,
of cool
everybody.
Things.
Go to AmericanHerbalistsGuild.org, I imagine, or Google them.
Exactly.
And be part of it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Were there any particular formulas for the herbal wines that stood out to you? Or is it just kind of like a free-for-all of different kinds of herbal wine?
They used a lot of different herbs, just also single herbs in wine. And let's say, for example, they put thyme. They put thyme in the wine, they infused it, then they made thyme wine. A lot of the uses that we use for thyme today are similar. So there's a lot of overlap with, how the plant is still used today as medicine. But it could also be, as depending on the dosage and the frequency of use, it could also really help with more serious issues of the body.
Right.
So, because that's all they had really as medicine. They had herbs, they had plants, and they had other techniques as well that they developed over time. But, you know, they didn't have pharmaceuticals or, you know, hospitals as we do today. So they really knew plants, I feel, much, much better than we do today.
Well, you know, Greek medicine's pretty famous. So, you know.
Yeah. And all of the cultures around the Mediterranean region who have a similar materia medica. You know, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Persians, this whole region, people were really embedded into herbal medicine. And each culture really has brought down to us the gifts of their traditions. So I agree, the Greeks definitely have a big influence, but I always like to, we can always learn from other cultures as well.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. Tara just produced for Learning Herbs a series with Sherelle Washington called Folk Medicine, Changing the Narrative. And she's a Black herbalist from Oakland, and she brings a lot of her traditions and cultures and uses those to inspire people to find theirs. And I love that we're having this conversation because it shows people that there's traditions and medicinal herb traditions around the world that you can explore and learn from, you know, from your own heritage or one you happen to be more interested in, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it's so great that we're in this movement right now where we are remembering all these traditions and we're talking about them. So otherwise they would just stay buried and it would be so unfortunate.
And you don't have to have Greek heritage to go to Greece or to join you and learn from you, right? I mean, it's about your interest and passions and
of course.
What's fun for you and the fact that you're bringing these, I don't know, like, well, you know, Greek stories, history, mythology, for those of us who learn these things in high school or college, we know this is a culture we've learned a lot about, at least I have. So it does kind of fit, like, oh, how can I fit herbs into this history? It's kind of like when I was in college and I took art history classes and I was like, oh, this is another way of looking at history is through art. And then you're not looking at it through all the wars all the time. You know, you can look at it through something beautiful like art. And here you're giving an opportunity to learn through herbalism, the culture through herbalism, and food and wine and fun, the important part.
Exactly. So many different ways to learn and be inspired by ancient traditions and continue on the heritage of herbal medicine.
I love all these little threads too that remain as hints to some of these ancient stories, like how you're saying the bay tree is called Daphne.
Yeah.
Or talking about the word laureate and honor. Mm-hmm. And that's such a sweet part of learning about ancestral herbalism practices is finding those little hints and those through threads that have survived so many years to point us back.
That's the impressive part. Yes, exactly. It's been 2,000, 3,000 years more. So it's nice to be a part of that conversation today.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, would you like to share about another herbal myth? I love mythology. So I'm curious if you have any other.
I was so obsessed with Greek mythology when I was a kid reading those stories, like the Cliff Note versions of the Odyssey stories, you know?
Yes. So another myth that I really enjoy sharing is about the oak tree. And the oak tree is the Quercus is the genus, and there's several different species. So the oak tree was considered the most sacred tree in ancient Greece. It was associated with Zeus, who was the king of the Olympian gods. And Zeus was in control of the sky, thunderstorms. He would throw lightning bolts, and he was just the man in charge. And there is scientific evidence that oak trees are the type of tree that get hit most by lightning. So perhaps the ancient Greeks noticed this happening and they said, this must be Zeus's tree because he keeps throwing his lightning bolts at it. So they associated this tree with Zeus and they built a very famous sanctuary called Dodona, or in English, it would be called Dodona. So in antiquity, it was a very famous sanctuary. It's located in northwestern Greece. And it's an archaeological site today, but in antiquity, people would travel to this sanctuary, and for whatever problem they had, they would ask the priestesses there for help. And one of the cool things about this sanctuary was that it was the trees that delivered the oracle. So the priestesses would stand in a grove of oak trees, and they would listen to the sounds around them. So whatever sounds of the grove they heard, they interpreted it as the oracle of Zeus. So whether it was the leaves rustling at a certain moment, or a bird flapping its wings, or the acorns falling to the ground, all of those were symbols and suggestions, or, you know, they were sounds that would get interpreted to answer each person's question.
People might look at, hear stories like that and go, oh, like, oh, these ancient people, how quaint. But it was rituals like that that connected people to the natural world and made them make decisions to not harm it, because they were so, that grove of oak trees was so sacred, they wouldn't consider chopping it down and put
exactly
a something or another. So
yeah,
there's a lot of wisdom, right?
Yes. Yeah. So the oak trees, people still call it the tree. So it just is the definition of the tree, like a tree, like oak tree is the tree. And yeah, people still know it is connected to Zeus, but it has a very beautiful presence. It just, it has a powerful presence that symbolizes strength, wisdom, power, all of these things that Zeus had represented. It was embodied in the oak tree.
I think kind of curious. I mean, Greece has been, you know, Christian for so long. How are the ancient myths woven in and respected and believed in the culture?
Yeah, so people are, they're very familiar with all of the Greek myths. They grow up with them. They're taught them in school. It's definitely part of their cultural heritage, and part of it's ingrained in their history. So it's definitely something that they teach their children, and it's part of their educational system. So it's been separated from religion, and it's now become just part of ancient Greek history and something to be proud about. Because also it's so popular around the world for people to learn about Greek myths, it's a point of pride for Greek people. And the religious part, there's not many practices with plants as compared to antiquity and how they use them. But surprisingly, the Christian church does have some plants associated with sacredness and holiness incorporated in the rituals of the Greek church. And one example that I'll quickly tell you is about the palm tree. And there's a myth about the palm tree in antiquity. There was Zeus's wife, Hera. She was pregnant with twins. She was giving birth to Artemis and Apollo. And she landed on an island. And as she was giving birth, she clung to a palm tree. And the palm tree became a symbol of victory and celebration because it helped her through a difficult moment delivering birth. The palm tree became incorporated into the festivals and religious customs of both the god and goddess, Apollo and Artemis. So all of their temples, there was always palm branches and that motif. Fast forward to today, in the Christian church, there is a holiday named after the palm tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Palm Sunday. So the symbolism of the palm tree continues into Christianity. And in the Greek church for Palm Sunday, there are palms are handed out. And so that myth, that symbolism got carried through from antiquity to modern Christianity. So there are some overlaps, and there's more examples of that too. So it's not just that the ancient Greek religious practices are completely dead. They are still, some of them are still embedded in Christianity.
You find you have like elders and people and connections to do what you can to bring back older uses of plants or rituals? Are you finding that harder, that you're having to almost incorporate things you're learning from other Western cultures and sort of piece things back together? Is it hard to find a solid, you know, tradition?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you are in Greece, because people who live in villages and, or, you know, there's a lot of people live in villages. Most people live in the city, of course, but people who live in villages are very isolated and they have their own traditions and customs and maybe some peculiar superstitions. So everywhere you go, you can learn something new from someone from the older generation. And not everything is everywhere you go. So it's interesting that there could be some mountain traditions with certain plants that I won't know about until I visit this specific village and I get to speak to this specific elder. But it takes time to know who those people are and for them to mm-hmm. warm up to someone just popping in to, like, for them to share their secrets.
Of course. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, hearing you mention the mountain landscape prior to this interview, you said that this landscape is one of your biggest inspirations. And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about what inspires you so much about this landscape and some of its ties to ancient sacred rituals that included plants?
Absolutely. So Greece, surprisingly, is covered 80% mountains.
Whoa.
So Greece is a very mountainous country, which people don't realize because when people come here for vacation, all they think about is going to the beach.
Yeah.
Which is understandable because there are so many islands here and beautiful beaches. But mountains are everywhere, and they're really quite impressive. Mount Olympus is the highest mountain peak in Greece. In ancient Greece, it was the home of the Olympian gods. So that mountain in particular is entrenched with a lot of mystery and mythology. And what I find really inspiring about the mountains is that they have such a strong connection to antiquity and the present, and they hold so many secrets. So, if I'm going on a hike, I'm going to be surprised what plants I'll find. Maybe I'll come across an archaeological site that used to be a sacred altar, or just the history of the mountain, of how it's used today. There is a specific plant called mountain tea, and it's in the Lamiaceae family. It's in the mint family, and the Latin name is Cytharides. And mountain tea is native to Greece, and depending on which mountain you're on, there'll be a different species of this plant. So it's mountain-specific and species-specific. So that herb in particular is very well known across Greece. It's very good for the immune system, respiratory system. It's a go-to herb for people when they're sick, similar to sage, how that plant can help the body. And it grows on mountains. So it's a very mountain-specific plant, and it connects people with the landscape.
Wow. That's so magical that there's different species on each. Oh my God.
Yeah. For the botanical geek, for the herb nerd, Tara, I think you're going to be going over there soon.
Yeah, mountain to mountain.
I know a lot of people, Maria, listening, have this fantasy now that they want to go to Greece and go around the mountains and seaside with you and looking for plants and hearing the stories and everything. And I'm wondering, like, what do you do tours, and what do they entail, and what do you weave into these tours?
Yes, I do tours, and I'm so excited about them.
How did you know, John?
I'm so excited. This year I have created a variety of tours. Some are on islands, some are on mountains, and each one will have a combination of herbal medicine, botanical hikes, meeting with locals who really know the land and who have their own practices of herbal medicine or harvesting olives during harvest season. What else? There's so much I could share. Rituals, oracles. So an upcoming herbal tour will be on the island of Kithera, where a famous herbalist, Juliet D. Barclay-Levy, once lived.
Yes.
And
yeah, watch that movie. It was very influential when that came out from me.
Yeah. So we're going to visit her cottage where she lived. And this year, the first tour that I hosted there was last year. And this year, hosting it again is going to be at the end of June. And Rosemary Gladstar and Tish Streeton will be our special guests this year. So very excited
about that. So let me get this straight. I can go to Greece, tour herbs with you in beautiful places, and go to Juliet D. Barclay-Levy's place with you and Rosemary Gladstar and Tish Streeton.
Yes, but by the time this podcast is live, we will be sold out. So so maybe, I'm very excited about that one. And then I'll also have some retreats that are in the summertime in August. I'll have a retreat on the island of Samothrace, which is known as the Wild Island. It's not populated with tourists. It's not fancy. It's like really bare. For people who really like being in nature. So we're going to immerse ourselves in that.
Wow.
And then a couple of tours in northern Greece in September and October, looking at mountain rituals and going to the Oracle of Dodoni to see that archaeological site there and connect with Zeus and his oak tree. So really, really exciting tours and retreats this year. And of course, I would love herbalists from the States to come and really immerse themselves in Greek herbal medicine and the landscape here.
Sounds so magical. I want to go.
I know. And on the GreekHerbalist.com, I just want to mention, rewind, there are other courses, there's some online things, and there's a blog and books that, you know, you could follow Maria. And next time you'll be able to get into that tour with Rosemary and
exactly,
because you'll know about it.
Exactly.
this is incredible.
Wow. Just thank Maria, thank you so much for joining us on Herb Mentor Radio. I'm so grateful. And I'm now just want to geek out more about Greek mythology and plants. And,
Yes.
And thanks for all your writing on Learning Herbs, Herb Mentor. Look out for Maria's stuff there too. And as I have said, it's thegreekherbalist.com. And Maria, thank you so much for joining
thanks
us
so
on Herb
much,
Mentor
John.
Radio.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Oh, Tara, one more thing.
Oh, yeah. What's up?
Would you share an herb note with us?
I would love to. Let's do this.
Yes.
Welcome to Herb Notes. I'm Tara Ruth. Oh, Echinacea, how I love thee. This beautiful plant not only supports pollinators with its abundant blooms, but also offers many benefits for us humans too. Echinacea angustifolia and Echinacea purpurea is most well known for helping to address colds and flu, but its gifts go far beyond internal immune support. Let's dive into three key benefits of Echinacea. 1. Echinacea for cold and flu. As an immune stimulant, Echinacea can help address mild symptoms associated with colds and flu like sore throat. At the onset of a cold, I often take Echinacea tincture or drink Echinacea tea to help support my immune system. When working with Echinacea, I use the roots, leaves, and flowers to support my body. And I reach for Echinacea in more acute situations, and then if I'm looking for an herb to help bolster my immune system over time, I usually opt more for elderberry or astragalus. 2. Echinacea for mild wounds. Echinacea is an antimicrobial herb, so I often apply it to little scrapes and cuts to help support my skin's healing process. For external usage, I like to create a topical fomentation with Echinacea tea. 3. Echinacea for recurring acne. Just as Echinacea can help support the skin's healing process from mild wounds, internal and external usage of Echinacea can help address some skin conditions like recurring acne. This is due not only to Echinacea's antimicrobial properties, but also the effects it has on the lymphatic system. Echinacea is a lymphagogue that can help promote lymphatic drainage within the body. And just to note, as an immune stimulant, there's conflicting info about whether Echinacea may adversely impact folks with autoimmune conditions. So if someone has an autoimmune condition, it's safest to avoid Echinacea or see an herbalist to take stock of their specific needs. Want to learn more about Echinacea's benefits? Visit herbnotes.cards to grab a free deck of our top 12 herb notes. This has been Herb Notes with me, Tara Ruth.
Herb Mentor Radio and Herb Notes are 100% sustainably wildcrafted podcasts, written, performed, and produced by Tara Ruth and me, John Gallagher. Sound engineering by Zach Frank. Visit herbmentorradio.com to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and to find out how you can be part of Herb Mentor, which is a website that you must see to believe. Herb Mentor Radio is a production of learningherbs.com LLC, all rights reserved. Thank you very, very, very much for listening.